Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us Dr. Katia Hoyer. Dr. Hoyer is a visiting research fellow at King's College London and has written for, among other publications, The Washington Post, History Today, and has been on the BBC. And today we are discussing her book, Blood and Iron, The Rise and Fall of the German Empire, 1871 to 1918, published by the History Press. Welcome, Dr. Hoyer.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Doctor, why did you write this book?
Largely because it is this year, the 150th anniversary of the foundation of the first German nation state. And I wanted to make sure that there's some sort of debate around how far Germany has come since then, where Germany stands today in Europe and in the world. Whether it's indeed succeeded to form a sort of sense of nationhood since then. I'm just intrigued by the way that it's basically the youngest European nation state, and not much debate has been around has been happening around its kind of identity today, if you will. Even in this 150th anniversary, in Germany, this hasn't really been picked up all that much, mainly because I think it isn't quite as much of a black or white issue as some of the other kind of more darker episodes in German history, and therefore people don't really quite know where to place this event. So I wanted to make sure that there's some sort of debate going on, and hopefully the book has achieved that this year.
If your book could be said to have a thesis, what would it be?
That the first incarnation of Germany, namely the sort of so-called Second Empire, was at least a semi-democracy. It's often kind of put into a line with Nazism later and sort of, you know, almost seen as a precursor to that. And I strongly rail against that and think the German Empire, as it's called, needs to be seen on its own terms and evaluated in a more nuanced and more complicated way than has been the case so far.
So you would not agree with the so-called Sonderweg thesis, most prominently associated with Hans Ulrich Wieler?
No, and I think the consensus over the last few decades in German historiography has moved away from that as well. But nonetheless, because of various issues in the first, sort of German nation state, it's still been interpreted as a sort of very one-sided, negative kind of political entity that suddenly entered the European landscape. Whereas I think we do need to appreciate the fact that there was a parliament universally elected by men still, but nonetheless quite democratic for the time. All men over the age of 25 were allowed to vote. It also, as much as it stands in the tradition of Prussian militarism, it also stands in the tradition of Prussian kind of liberal sentiment as well. And I think that's all been undervalued to some extent. So I do rail against the idea that kind of Nazism and nationalism and all the problems that we see in the 20th century are easily traced back to the origins of Germany in 1871.
How did the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation differ from other states in pre-1800 Europe? And following from that, do you agree with the recent revisionist arguments of people like Peter Wilson, which evaluate the Holy Roman Empire on a higher level than was traditionally the case?
Well, the Holy Roman Empire was a strange concept, really. I mean, you know, it's famously been said that it was neither holy, nor was it Roman, nor was it an empire. It's basically a sort of collective term for over 400 principalities that existed. So this is sort of like dukedoms and states and kingdoms and city-states and all sorts of kind of German-speaking political entities. And the only loosely sort of combining factor there that made them this Holy Roman Empire was the fact that they had some form of allegiance to the Holy Roman Emperor. That usually just meant defensive action. So say if the Holy Roman Emperor decided that war was needed against an enemy that wasn't part of the German state, then they should, in theory, have rallied behind him and followed him into war. That doesn't always work, not least because the Holy Roman Emperor was usually a Catholic, and therefore the Protestant northern states would quite often find it difficult to see why they should follow him basically into a conflict that might have nothing to do with them. So basically the Holy Roman Emperor himself always ended up haggling and begging and pleading and cajoling and threatening the other states into even this very basic kind of concept of military alliance. So it's a bit misleading, that term, and also the fact that then this is known as, or this is kind of often perceived as, the first German Empire is a bit complicated or kind of a bit problematic, because it doesn't really have kind of the trappings of a unified state in that sense, or of a unified empire. So in that respect, it is different from other states such as, say, France or England, in the sense that it isn't really a centralized political entity, but more of a kind of loose conglomeration of German-speaking states.
How did the German Bund, which came into existence in 1814, 1815, differ from the empire, and could it have been said subsequently to have been a step in the direction of German unity?
Yes, to the latter. So it definitely was a step in that direction, simply because it went a little bit further than the Holy Roman Empire. So they also, what they had in common was that they also acted as a defensive agreement. And in this case, this usually worked. So to give you an example, when Prussia and Austria begin to sort of have a conflict with Denmark in the north over the dukedoms of Schleswig and Holstein, this defensive kind of mechanism of the Bund is triggered, and the other states follow them into that conflict, even though in theory they have nothing really to gain from it. So it worked. But it also acted as a loose supranational kind of entity on economic terms. So there was, for instance, some form of market beginning to crystallize among those then 39 states. And that's another difference, actually. They unified those over 400 entities into just 39 German states after the defeat of Napoleon in 1815. And so basically it made it a lot easier for those states to have some sort of agreement with one another over certain economic issues as well. So, for example, railway network, sort of the development thereof, was beginning to really become an issue to the larger industrializing states like Prussia, for example. They wanted to have that across the different German lands, so that you could transport goods and raw materials, coal, iron ore in particular, from A to B without paying too much kind of, you know, internal tariffs and taxes and things. And so out of that came a much closer economic collaboration. But importantly, it still didn't go as far as to say, for instance, unify the currency or weights and measurements and all the other things that you need for a unified market. So it's a step further in the direction of German unification, but not one that can be seen as a nation state yet.
Would you evaluate the revolution of 1848 as, politically speaking, a failure?
Well, it's famously been said that that was the turning point where Germany failed to turn, or Europe failed to turn. In that sense, it was a failure because it was crushed and didn't achieve its aims. So it was a peculiar mix, really, of socialism, liberalism, people just being upset about the sort of dire conditions that they lived in. There was a series of bad harvests in the 1840s as well, so people were starving particularly badly in those years. And all of those things combined into a very unhappy European population that wanted to see change. There was also still a hangover from the French Revolution, in the sense that people had begun to think about power structures and the divine right of kings was being broken down and all of those things. So if you want to judge the revolutions on the basis of did they immediately bring down the old regime, so the sort of, you know, more traditionalist concepts of monarchy, then it was a failure. But what they did achieve was that the elites were seriously frightened, because in various points in Germany, particularly in areas like Bavaria and so on, where there were direct attacks on the palaces of the nobility and on the nobility themselves, they came so close to achieving their aims that the old elites were basically frightened into making concessions. And so you do, for instance, now see fairly strong parliaments in places like Prussia that are beginning to get more rights. So the Prussian parliament at this point, for example, is in charge of budget, for example. So they pretty much decide whether or not the Prussian king can go to war. And all of those things are implemented not because the nobility have suddenly found a sort of deep longing for democracy, but it's because they're frightened of what will happen if they don't give the masses something. And so these compromises that you begin to see all over the German lands and elsewhere as well come out of the fear that the 1848 revolutions have triggered. So in that sense, they push a very, very reluctant and resilient and stubborn old regime into making the reforms that were needed, which otherwise wouldn't have happened because they wouldn't have voluntarily relinquished any power.
So that's why Prussia had a revised pseudo-responsible parliament and constitution as of 1850.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, even that was still despised and opposed by a lot of people in Prussia, but it was seen as a necessary step to avoid kind of unrest on that scale again.
Could it be said the case that in retrospect the Kleindeutsch solution to the issue of German unity was predetermined?
Yes, in a way, because that so what this in effect means is that Austria was pushed out of the out of a sort of German nation state that was beginning to evolve. I think it was more or less inevitable that the clash between the two largest German states in the Bund, namely Prussia and Austria, had to come to a head in some way. And Otto von Bismarck, the Prussian prime minister later from 1862, realized this and basically said from the off that wasn't going to happen. You can't have two very sort of powerful and strong-minded and single-minded entities within the Bund, and both of them wanted kind of preeminence over it. The other problem was that in the 1815 arrangement of the Bund, the decision was made to give Austria the chairmanship over the Bund in perpetuity. So it didn't revolve around all of the German states, and not even between Prussia and Austria. They just had the chairmanship and that was it. And as Prussia became more and more powerful, it became more and more difficult for Austria, which had kind of stuck with the very old-fashioned agrarian system whilst Prussia was moving ahead with industrialization. So it became more difficult for Austria eventually to justify why they should maintain the leadership of the Bund in perpetuity. And so eventually some sort of decision had to be made, and Prussia eventually provokes a war with Austria, and that in 1866, and the so-called Brothers' War, or German War, basically, because it was fought between the two German states, settled that question once and for all, and it made it impossible for Austria to be part of this new political construct that was being developed with all of the other German states in it.
Why was Otto von Bismarck appointed as Prussian Minister President in 1862?
He had wanted that role for quite some time. He was a very, very ambitious Prussian aristocrat, a so-called Junker, as they were called, but had very extreme and radical views and was sort of known as a bit of a hothead among the Prussian elite. So the previous king during the 1848 revolutions, which we just talked about, was Frederick Wilhelm IV. When he died, his brother Wilhelm I took over. So he was Wilhelm I of Prussia and then later also the first German Kaiser. And he was quite a sort of, I wouldn't say a quiet individual, but very, very traditional, old-fashioned, also very old. I mean, he was born in the previous century in, I want to say, 97, 1797. So very old-fashioned, very traditional. The idea of appointing a sort of hothead and extremist, almost like Bismarck, frightened him a little bit. And so what he did first of all is he just sent him out of the country. So he became the Prussian ambassador to Russia and then to France, so that he basically was kept quiet with fairly influential positions, but not a position that was actually in Germany or in Berlin. And so eventually what happened was that at home, at the Prussian court, the Prussian king, Wilhelm I, ran into problems with Parliament. Parliament had become increasingly liberal and quite confident now. So they were basically pushing for their rights, particularly that right I was mentioning earlier to have the right to set the military budget, whilst the king was still of the opinion that the army is under his command, so therefore he gets to decide how to run it and how much money to spend on it. And so the two clashed over military reforms, king and parliament simply refused to pass the budget that the king wanted for his military reforms. And that whole conflict was so heated that eventually Willem had a bit of a breakdown, like a mental breakdown, and burst into tears and said, fine, he'll abdicate and just pass the crown over to his liberal son, Frederick III, who was married to, had an English wife, Victoria, who was Queen Victoria's oldest daughter, and brought the sort of English liberalism into the marriage as well. So here was kind of a power couple in the waiting, wanting to reform Prussia into a more liberal kingdom. And so Wilhelm was on the brink of just giving up. And that frightened the old elites at court. And they sent Otto von Bismarck a famous telegram to Paris, which basically said, hurry, there's danger and delay. And Bismarck immediately hurried back from France and basically said to Willem, you do not abdicate. If you abdicate now, you basically give in to the liberals and they will destroy Prussia. Don't worry, you make me minister president or prime minister if you want to see it like that. And I will go in and sort this conflict out with Parliament. And that's effectively what he did. He stood in front of Parliament and said these famous words that are also the title of my book, that only with blood and iron will the great questions of the day be decided. Meaning, never mind your liberalism, what Prussia needs is the means to sort of force its decision. Its decisions through, so blood and iron meaning war, and therefore he just basically said to them, we'll reform the military with or without you, that's going to be the basis of our power in Prussia, and just ran an illegal army budget, so he completely ignored Parliament, reformed the army illegally, against the constitution, and thus basically made himself indispensable to the king, because that was entirely Bismarck's doing, and nobody else could have done it and would have done it in the same way. And so he remained minister president after that.
Why did Bismarck in 1867, after the victory of the Six Weeks' War, agree to universal male suffrage for the North German Confederation and then subsequently for the German Reich?
That is a good question. I think he regretted that to some extent later when this became a problem for him. I think, well, mainly again, it was, I think, out of a sense of fear, first of all. So this idea, he had seen the 1848 revolutions himself and was so appalled by them at the time because they'd come so close to actually toppling and potentially killing the Prussian king, that he'd gathered an army himself on his estate in Prussia, just literally peasants with pitchforks. And was on his way to marching in Berlin, into Berlin basically to try and help the king. So that's how strong the response from Bismarck's side was to the 1848 revolutions. And therefore, I think just trying to prevent that from happening again was one thing. Another reason was that the new elite, so basically industrialists, the rising middle classes, the bourgeoisie, so people like that, were very liberal minded, and were becoming really, really powerful due to the huge amounts of money that they accumulated. And this meant that the power balance was shifting away from the old elites, the aristocracy, whose wealth basically was based on land ownership and therefore dwindling due to mass production and so on. The prices for food and grain and stuff like that had literally just plummeted. And so Bismarck's kind of weighing up where does the power lie now? And as it's shifting towards the new elites, and the new elites want more liberalism and they want rights in parliament because they haven't got the titles and the kind of inherited power that the old elites had, that's why he's beginning to shift power over to their side to get them on side with his schemes and with his plans. And lastly, it's just a question of making political alliances as well. So Bismarck knew that if he wants to kind of run the country using money, you know, reforming tax systems and so on, he needs those new elites on side, and the only way to do that was to give them more power in parliament. So it's a pragmatic decision. There's nothing to do with Bismarck's sort of personal ideology. If he could have kept a more traditional monarchy, he would have done.
What was the Kulturkampf?
Basically an argument over church control in Germany. So quite literally it's culture wars, and perhaps in that way it's a bit relatable to what we're seeing at the moment as well, because the church still had huge amounts of control over things like education, marriage, death, you know, any kind of major events in people's lives were still very much dominated by the church. And Germany was a third Catholic, two-thirds Protestant once formed. So the southern states like Bavaria, Baden and Württemberg, they're Catholic. And the north under Prussia, they were Protestant. And Bismarck, being a staunch Protestant himself, was worried about the influence that the papacy and international Catholicism would have on German culture. Now that he'd formed Germany, he wanted it to be a sort of unified nation state. Meanwhile, the Pope didn't help the situation, because he was basically arguing that all of these new civilizations, as he called the new nation states in Europe, so that's mainly Germany and Italy at this point, would bring. So he called them basically evil influences over sort of people's lives, and therefore started meddling on a political level with these new nation states, and that's what Bismarck was worried about. So for Catholics in Germany, that basically meant a conflict of interest between their nation state and their religion, and that's a dangerous situation to be in. So Bismarck was quite concerned about the sort of security risk that might have posed. So say if he wanted to go to war, and the Pope said, that's not right, it's an evil war, Catholics don't fight in it, suddenly you've got a third of Germans thinking about whether or not to rally, you know, to the flag, as it were. And that's what Bismarck was concerned with. And so what he tried to do is secularize society. So marriage, for example, and that's still the case in Germany today, you have to have a civil marriage. That's the bit that's legal. If you just marry in a church, then you're not legally married. That's something that Bismarck introduced. But also things like if you wanted to be a priest, you had to train now at a sort of state-run or funded university and things like that. And he was basically trying to class power back from the church into state hands. And this worked to some extent in that, as I say, some of these secularization measures are still in place. But in other ways, it didn't work, because Bismarck had to row back in the end and basically undo many of these measures, because he needed the Catholics in the fight against socialism. And so in the late 1870s, he made up with the new Pope and ended up working with the Catholics in Germany against the socialists.
How unique was the conservative term in German society after 1873? Could not the same tendencies be seen, say, the UK at the same time?
Well, German conservatism had very particular strains to it. So first of all, as I was just saying, there's both Catholics and Protestants, which each bring a sort of particular brand of conservative, social conservatism with them. Then you also have a really quite virulent anti-Semitic element in there. This comes largely from the this kind of Prussian Junker caste in the northeast of Prussia, some of whom are really quite extremely anti-Semitic, and that's another strain that I wouldn't say is entirely unique to Germany, but it's certainly more widespread in the German elites, in conservative elites compared to say the UK or France. So those are two particular elements of that, I would say, that make it fairly unique. What they do also have in common is this kind of preservation of royal power, and particularly, of the monarchy and the sort of old social system, if you will.
And why did Bismarck push through a policy of so-called state socialism in the period after 1878?
Largely to appease the working classes. So the problem that he encountered was that Prussia had already begun, even before unification, to industrialize extremely quickly. So in 1815, when Napoleon was defeated, Prussia played a key role in that defeat. And so, as a almost like a reward, it was given the Rhineland in the west, and this contained vast amounts of coal and iron ore. And became the sort of industrial heartlands of Prussia. And with that, it industrialized extremely quickly. With that, obviously, came an increase in the sort of urban working classes. And suddenly, you had kind of large urban centers like Berlin and Cologne and Hamburg and so on, all creating pretty horrendous environments for people to live in. So you had kind of large tenement housing suddenly springing up everywhere, horrible kind of labyrinths of just, kind of tiny, damp little flats where people lived with their entire extended families and so on. Conditions were pretty dire. And so the socialism basically began to appeal. Marx and Engels had written their Communist Manifesto around about the time of the revolutions of 1848, so you now had a kind of term and an ideology to go with that, and this was becoming a real threat. So the first socialist party, the SPD, is still Germany's oldest party to this day. The current Chancellor Olaf Scholz is an SPD man, was beginning to establish itself and find its feet, and Bismarck was supremely worried about that. Striking had become a huge thing. Trade unions. By 1914, they have 3 million members, and that's beginning under Bismarck as well. So he needs to do something, and crushing these uprisings isn't an option in perpetuity. It had just about still worked in 1848, but it wasn't going to work forever. And so what he thought was that if the state offers some form of socialism, i.e. better working conditions, things like old age pensions, accident insurance, those kinds of things, then the workers would have less of a reason to flock to the kind of more radical ideology of revolution and violence basically being used in the class struggle, as it were. So that's why he introduced those things, and he's still to this day sort of celebrated as the founding father of the German welfare system because of that.
Why did Bismarck pursue a conservative foreign policy after 1871?
Well, it depends if you want to kind of completely brand it that way. His main concern was was Germany's geopolitical position right in the center of Europe. So when he'd formed and merged the German states together and formed Germany in 1871, he had suddenly created the largest nation state in Europe, both in terms of land mass and population, and it completely blew the very fragile power balance of Europe out of the water. And therefore, he needed to now reassure particularly Britain and Russia. There was no way that Germany was ever going to reconcile with France at this point, due to the way that the Franco-Prussian War had been used as a means of unifying Germany. But he was looking towards trying to appease both Russia and Britain, and at the same time work with the Austro-Hungarian Empire and so on, to try and basically anchor Germany in Europe and stabilize it, so it wouldn't be destroyed by external enemies immediately. And so his entire foreign policy was geared towards that, trying to make sure that Germany could find a role for itself that nobody else in Europe would have a problem with, and at the same time isolating France diplomatically and politically, so that it couldn't find kind of alliances against Germany in any of the other states, particularly Russia and Britain. And so what Bismarck did effectively was to try and establish Germany as the honest broker between the other nations. So when the Ottoman Empire, for instance, begins to crumble in the southeast of Europe, And everyone is wanting a piece of that cake, and trouble is brewing in the Balkans between all of the large nations. Bismarck basically calls them all to Berlin, and holds a congress to try and sort this out, always saying, "We haven't got an interest in this ourselves. We don't want parts of the Balkans. We are quite contented with the size of Germany at the moment." And the same is true for empire building as well. He was always staunchly averse to the idea of Germany as an imperial power, building a world empire. And so again, this was geared towards trying to make sure that both France and Britain wouldn't feel, that Germany would become a threat to them on the world stage. And again, same thing. So Bismarck hosts a conference, the sort of infamous one where they divided up Africa basically between the other European nations, and again says Germany has no interest in that. We're just here as a sort of stabilizing force, and he sets Germany up in that way. So that's the entire kind of rationale of his foreign policy.
Why was Bismarck dismissed in 1890 by William II, and how do the subsequent policies of the so-called New Course differ from those of Bismarck?
Wilhelm II came into power in 1888, after a very, very brief spell by his father, Frederick III, who I mentioned earlier, the liberal, who had throat cancer, and only stayed on the throne for 99 days, during which he actually couldn't speak. He was that ill with throat cancer. So everybody knew basically it would pass over to Wilhelm II, who was Wilhelm I's grandson. He was only 29 years old when he became Kaiser, and had a really kind of particular idea in mind as to how he wanted to run the country. So in his mind, it was time for a new generation. Germany now had a young Kaiser. This young state had a young, dynamic Kaiser, and that's how he wanted to present himself. And he certainly did not want to start his reign with sort of bloodshed or any kind of suppression of the people. And so Bismarck's anti-socialist agenda, so apart from the state socialism, which we talked about earlier, Bismarck also still suppressed the socialist movements, particularly strikes, quite often by sending soldiers in and basically just having them bloodily sort of crushed. And that's what he and Wilhelm II argued over quite severely. So Wilhelm II said, "I want to be the Kaiser of the people, or of the rabble," as he even phrased it, quoting Frederick the Great, meaning, he wanted the people to love him basically, and didn't want to start his reign off on this very, very negative footing. So the two men clashed quite severely. The constitution didn't help with that. So Bismarck had set the constitution up so that basically the Kaiser sits at the top, kind of presiding over the whole system, but really it's the chancellor that runs it for him. This combination only works if the two get on, if you have one strong and one weak partner basically, and the two work in tandem. That had worked perfectly fine under Wilhelm I, and then Bismarck basically just running the show for him. Now that you had two very single-minded men there, in Wilhelm II and Bismarck, the two clashed constantly, particularly over socialism. So when it came down to it, basically over the next 2 years, everything ground to a halt because the two basically couldn't decide on what to do. So by 1890, 2 years later, this conflict had completely gone pear-shaped for Bismarck. And ultimately, it's the Kaiser who appoints or dismisses his chancellors, and Bismarck had to go. And then, as you say, a so-called new course was implemented by Bismarck's successor, Leo von Caprivi, who was trying to continue on a path of sort of appeasement towards the workers, a path that Bismarck by then had abandoned, and basically introduced further measures, like he banned Sunday work, for example, and some other measures to try and keep the working classes happy. Most of whom saw this as a bit of a fig leaf, so they didn't really take it all that seriously, and continued to support the SPD and the trade unions. So that problem didn't really go away, which is why basically Caprivi didn't last all that long. He lasted 4 years. And then the elites said, no, his new course had gone far too far in appeasing the working classes, and he needed to go as well.
Do you agree with the historian John Rawl, who his thesis wherein, as per the same, he argues that after 1890, Germany had a personal regime of monarchical rule?
That's been pushed back a little bit now by other historians as well. So Christopher Clark, for example, is also saying that that's going a little bit too far. That's what Wilhelm wanted, certainly. So his idea was ultimately to get rid of the constitution, get rid of the office of the chancellor, because he didn't see any point in it. And he just wanted to run the country under this what he called personal rule. So basically like a direct, old-fashioned, absolute monarchy. That was simply impossible at the time. You just couldn't do that anymore because Europe had moved in a direction politically and then socially that made this kind of almost medieval system of monarchy impossible. You don't see that anywhere else either in Europe. So the other monarchies that still existed, particularly Britain, had also moved in a far more liberal and constitutional direction. The only aspect, I think, where Wilhelm did have a lot of power and exercised it as well is the appointment and dismissal of the government, effectively. So the Chancellor at this point was not in any shape or form responsible to Parliament, but only to the Kaiser. And therefore, that's quite powerful in the sense that if the Chancellor didn't do what the Kaiser wanted him to do, then, you know, you can just dismiss and appoint them. And that gives Wilhelm quite a lot of power over the sort of direction of government. But he himself was influenced very, very heavily by his social circle, the people around him, the circumstances that he found himself in. So he's by no means a free agent and can just exert that personal rule in the way, you know, that it's often been portrayed. He's certainly not a very kind of central, extremely central figure in this entire process, I don't think.
Why did William II appoint Bernhard von Bülow as Chancellor in 1900?
It's quite a complicated situation at this point. So Bülow was part of Wilhelm's personal social circle. Because he had dismissed Bismarck, and Bismarck had died at this point, in any case, he died in 98. So he was without kind of political advisors that were there previously. His father and grandfather were both dead. And so Wilhelm turns to this kind of very small and exclusive social circle, the so-called Liebenberg circle, and Bülow was part of that. So that's one reason. It's just basically a personal friend of Wilhelm's. Secondly, Bülow was actually quite a capable administrator, had a bit of a sort of history in sort of running state matters before, and was quite experienced in that way. So he seemed a good fit. And perhaps most importantly, he was happy for Wilhelm's kind of imperial policy. So for Germany to build a world empire, it's called Weltpolitik, for that to be implemented. And so Wilhelm just needed a chancellor that wouldn't constantly, you know, kind of advise caution, but actually just go ahead and build Germany's empire in the way that he wanted it to. He was also very good at building alliances in the Reichstag that was still there, obviously, and needed to be dealt with. The Reichstag is the German parliament, basically, and needed to pass all laws at this point, and is still universally elected by all males over the age of 25. So Bülow also proved quite capable of building alliances there that actually created majorities so that laws could be passed. So he seemed a good fit, basically, all round. One of Wilhelm's favourites, ideologically on the right side as far as Wilhelm was concerned, and able to implement those policies.
So you would say that Catherine Lehrmann, in her characterization of Bülow as, quote, the chancellor's courtier, goes a bit too far?
No, actually that works. I mean, like I said, he was part of this kind of very almost incestuous little circle of advisors that Wilhelm had gathered around him. So they, you know, kind of like a self-perpetuating power circle, really. And in that sense, it does come fairly close to being, you know, like a court kind of situation. So it works in that sense, but he just happens to also be quite a capable politician at the same time.
And why did Bülow fall in 1909?
Because that entire Liebenberg circle fell. So what happened was that one of Wilhelm's very, very close friends, Philipp zu Eulenburg, who was kind of at the heart of this Liebenberg circle, was exposed as a homosexual in the media, and there was a whole this was really aimed at the Kaiser, so the press basically were trying to indirectly criticize the Kaiser by exposing this scandal of his kind of inner court or his inner friendship circle. And Eulenburg made the mistake of fighting this in court as a libel case, which then meant it was dragged, like literally every detail of it, through the eyes of the public basically for years and years. And this forced Wilhelm to distance himself from the entire circle, and Bülow was part of that, and kind of part of the downfall was caused by that. The other problem was the so-called Daily Telegraph affair. What happened was that Wilhelm had given an interview to a British aristocrat who was a friend of his at his castle in England. And this aristocrat basically said to him, "Well, look, you said a really, kind of good series of comments here that show that Germany is really quite pro-Britain, and you are, and I think it would be a good idea if you published this," and sent these comments that were really just a private interview between the two men, in front of a fireplace in some castle in Britain, to the press, to the Daily Telegraph. It was standard protocol that any press comments on the royal family would be sent back to them for approval first before being published. So the Daily Telegraph kind of did the right thing, sent the whole script back to Germany. Bülow, as the leader of the government, was supposed to look over that and make sure that there's no kind of screamers in there. He didn't, for whatever reason. It's still contested why, but basically just passed it down. The sort of hierarchy didn't deal with it himself, and eventually the approval just came back from Germany without any changes to the script. So Wilhelm's kind of very clumsy and very unfortunate remarks that he made in private were suddenly published in the British press, and this contained comments like, "You English are mad, mad as March hares." Which he kind of jokingly said over a glass of whiskey, and suddenly they're there in the public eye. And Bülow was eventually blamed for that because he should have checked the script, and the fallout from that, the embarrassment of it, meant that some heads had to roll, and his was part of that. So that was another reason. It was both the scandal over the Liebenberg Circle as well as the Daily Telegraph affair, and Bülow had to go.
And wasn't it also the case that the failure of his bloc, Bülow bloc, which was elected in 1907, failed to remedy the issue of tax reform?
Yeah, I mean that became an increasing issue. So Bülow just about managed to build, as you say, the Bülow bloc after the so-called Hottentot elections over imperial issues. So basically, what happened was that a series of scandals came out of the German colonies. Most famously, the massacre that basically happened against the so-called Hottentot people, hence why the election was called after that as well. And Bülow argued on the back of that the imperial cause was still right and the policies were so popular that he basically got a very conservative pro-empire coalition elected back in because the German people were quite sort of happy for the empire to be extended and so on. And this Bülow bloc was a very fragile alliances of different conservative parties in the Reichstag. When that, however, failed to pass various different legislation, from tax reforms to various army bills and things as well, that were later than pushed through by Bethmann Hollweg, the following chancellor, he also had kind of served his purpose as a sort of negotiator between the Kaiser and his parliament, because that also didn't seem to work anymore. So there was absolutely no reason to keep Bülow in effect in the end.
Why was Bethmann Hollweg appointed chancellor when, unlike all the others, he did not have any diplomatic experience?
Well, it's maybe important to say that he didn't actually want to be chancellor either. He's said to have broken into tears when, like actually cried when he was told that he had to be the chancellor now, because he saw it as a bit of a poison chalice, which it was. An impossible position to be in at that point, with socialists and liberals becoming increasingly raucous in parliament, and you're supposed to sell them policies that come from a staunchly conservative Wilhelm. So he didn't want to be chancellor. They needed somebody who came from the outside, so it was in no way connected really to the whole Liebenberg circle, but it still needed to be somebody who Wilhelm trusted. So definitely an aristocrat. He had built a little bit of a reputation as a sort of military man, which is why he was deemed to be capable of pushing these army reforms through. So that was another reason, and these factors just fit. He just seemed a sort of calm, middle of the road, inoffensive politician who would be able to basically convince Parliament of some of the policies that needed to be passed, and he wasn't tainted by any of the past scandals, so there weren't too many candidates that fit that profile.
Would it be correct to say that you do not entirely agree with the new consensus on the origins of the Great War, being that as per which that Germany was not uniquely responsible and that both France and Russia were equally responsible?
I'm not sure that is the entirely the consensus. Certainly over here, there's still a raging debate about that. But yes, I don't know. I'm a bit enthused over this because I do think that Wilhelm was quite happy with the idea of a war in Europe. You can sense that and see that in a lot of his correspondence, not least in the sort of what's been dubbed the War Council of 1912, where he meets up with his military advisors, and they go through a sort of scenario of what would happen if Germany goes to war and when Germany goes to war and so on. So they're very kind of concrete war plans being made in 1912. You also have the Schlieffen Plan in place since 1905, which is basically a sort of plan to try and avert a two-front war situation. Initially in 1905, but then over the years, as they keep amending and discussing it, it becomes a bit of a formula for victory, really, in the eyes of Wilhelm and his staff. You have figures like Helmut von Moltke, who has a famous uncle, also called Helmut von Moltke, sometimes dubbed the Older, who basically played a key role in the Franco-Prussian War and therefore in the unification of Germany in 1871. And now his nephew, Helmut Moltke the Younger, needs his own war basically to prove his own worth, and is keen to push that and also pushes Wilhelm in that direction. So there's certainly a lot of German action towards war. But I'm not convinced that Wilhelm appreciated the nature, the scale, and the complexity of the conflict that would unleash eventually. So I do think that there is an element of German guilt there, but I don't think anybody appreciated the impact that technology would have, the way that the alliances would be triggered. Wilhelm, for instance, was completely obsessed with Britain due to his British or English heritage, through his mother's side of the family. He saw himself as part of the British royal family, and therefore was in himself convinced that Britain would stay out of it, which if they had, it would have been a completely different conflict. So I think there's a lot of hindsight still involved in these debates, in terms of attributing guilt to different parties. And it's not easy to untangle that from the situation as it was in 1914. So in my mind, there is an element of German guilt there because of the way that a local war in the Balkans and certainly in the East was desired and brought about through German action. But on the flip side, this kind of extremely complex situation in Europe was almost ripe for war in any case. So I don't think there is a straightforward answer to that.
So you would posit that there was a German guilt over and above anything that could be attributed to, say, Russia or France or, for that matter, Austria.
Certainly in the short term. So I think one way or another, you would have probably seen conflict in Europe, due to the situation that, you've just described as well, with the other European powers having, a sort of say in the hand in the conflict as well that was brewing. I mean, Bismarck quite famously said in the 1880s, some great European war is going to come out of some damn foolish thing in the Balkans, as he phrased it. This is decades before. So If you want to nail me down on this, I would say the way that the war unfolded in 1914 is down to German action and German direction, but conflict was on the cards one way or another.
Why did Germany enter the war united politically, the so-called Bergfrieden, and why did that unity subsequently decline?
It's the same effect, really, that you see in 1871 as well. So as Bismarck said, it would take blood and iron to get stuff done. And this is certainly true for German unity. The German states had as much in common as they had to divide them. And the only reason why they unified in 1871 was because of the wars against Denmark, Austria and France. And it's on the back of that, what I call defensive nationalism in the book, that Germany unifies. However, the same is true in 1914 as well. So when, you know, as we've just seen, there's an increasingly fractious political situation in Germany, whereby parliament is now, certainly from 1912, the last election before the war, split in half, almost literally, between the socialists and democrats and liberals on the one side, and the conservative elements on the other. And you have almost complete political stagnation. So when war breaks out in 1914, Wilhelm says to this very divided Reichstag, well, look, we're all in the same boat now. Germany needs to be defended. And I don't see or I don't know political parties anymore. He famously said, I only know Germans. And that really strikes a chord with people and works. So the socialists immediately and the social democrats immediately agree to abandon any strike action and ban it for the rest of the war. They also agreed to pass the military budget for the war effort. They even sign an enabling act right away in August 1914, which allows the executive to basically put the country in a sort of martial law situation and abandon all political power and they basically give up on democracy at this point, which isn't Germany isn't unique in that. This the same thing happens in France and in Britain as well, because emergency legislation needs to be passed quickly, but it happens more radically in Germany. You basically see the country run as a military dictatorship throughout the war, sometimes called the silent dictatorship, because it wasn't an actual change of the constitution, they just kind of did it. And so, you know, this Burgfriede thing is part of a wider problem, I think, that Germany has in its first incarnation, in that what binds it together is nationalism and is militarism and war. And you see that in 1914 as much as you do in 1871, and in that respect, not much had changed. So suddenly all of these religious and social differences that we just talked about become null and void, and Germany rallies together. This begins to break down in 1816 on the back of the fact that the war has now taken much longer than wasn't originally anticipated. So most people thought, you know, the sort of famous saying that the war would be over by Christmas, and certainly within a few months, because the last war that people had known, namely the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, was over in that time, as was the war against Austria, as was the war against Denmark. So certainly not since the Napoleonic Wars had Europe seen a war, you know, as sort of comprehensive and as large as that one. So people hadn't anticipated the size of it. They also hadn't anticipated that civilians would be affected by it, because of the labor blockade and other problems with food supplies and so on. So by 1916, people are starving. They're miserable. They haven't even got supplies. It's not just food. It's also things like coal, electricity, soap, coffee, all of that is becoming very scarce. And you end up with a situation that is affecting pretty much everyone in Germany. People are looking out, you know, the sort of lists that are being published at town halls and things of the people that have died in the war. People go there every day to check if their husbands, brothers, fathers, friends, and so on are on it. So it's pretty bad at this point, and it's not the defensive war anymore that the government had promised in 1914, and that's why the Burgfriede breaks down and turns kind of into its opposite, with the anger spilling over and being directed at the Kaiser now.
So you would date the origins of the so-called silent dictatorship to August, September 1914, not August 1916 when Falkenhayn is dismissed, or for that matter, July 1917 when Bethmann Hollweg is dismissed?
Well, the actual silent dictatorship starts in 1916, as you say, with it's called the third OHL, or the third kind of incarnation of the high command, of the German high command, because that's when the military takes over. So at that point, the third OHL has got almost the trappings of a government. They have a department for economics, one for censorship, one for foreign policy even. So at this point, the military really literally runs the entire country. What happens in 1914 with the Enabling Act, however, is that Parliament abdicates sort of its power over to the executive. And that creates a kind of temporary dictatorship situation, which hands power over to the political elites. The difference between the two is that obviously it's still civilian politicians in 1914 technically running the country, under the Chancellor, whilst from 1916 onwards, when you have foreign policy dictated by the military caste, suddenly you end up with a military dictatorship. That's the difference between the two. But one way or another, democracy is pretty much gone out of the window by 1914.
Would it be the case that Germany's defeat in the Great War automatically led to the end of the empire and the Prussian monarchy?
The problem is that when this defensive war idea is given up and you end up with this so-called Siegfried or victory peace, people take that very badly, and they're looking for someone to blame for that. And because the imperial regime insists on perpetuating a war that is quite blatantly lost, certainly from 1917 on, everyone can see that with the entry of the US into the war, whilst on the Eastern Front, the war has ended with Russian defeat. So, you know, it's obvious to all and sundry that Germany cannot win the war on the Western Front, and should, you know, seek peace in some shape or form. And because they don't, to the German people, it's more and more obvious that if they don't get rid of the Kaiser, they can't end this war. And this is then exacerbated by President Woodrow Wilson's demands that Germany needs to become a democracy before it can have peace. So ultimately, when Germany does sue for peace, it's an American demand that Germany must get rid of its monarchy first before it can have peace. And he says that very, very directly and explicitly, which also then means that for the German people, if they want peace, they need to get rid of the Kaiser and his regime. So one way or another, peace is tied to the abolishment of the monarchy.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Probably what I said at the beginning. So there's this idea that the German Empire was more than a militaristic dictatorship, because of the way that, as we've seen, Parliament causes repeated problems and causes the government to implement quite kind of progressive ideas such as the welfare state and so on, secularism and so on. So there is a huge element of modernity. It's at least a semi-democracy, and that's, I think, the key idea that I would like to get across. It shouldn't be entirely dominated by its end, in a way, and by what came out of the consequences of the First World War.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Dr. Hoyer, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of New Books Network. Thank you, Dr. Hoyer.
Thank you.